The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder if the life and miracles and resurrection of Jesus are really such accurate historical events. How come no historians from Jesus' day talked about them? Well, my friend, historians usually write long after the fact. That's why we call it history. After Jesus' influence began changing the world, only then would historians notice. Contemporary historians would have been talking about other things. Be that as it may, historians who lived not long after Jesus, and I mean not long at all after Jesus, did take notice, such as the Roman historian Tacitus and the Jewish historian Josephus. There is also a testimony in the Jewish Talmud and many other places. We will discuss the testimony of Jesus from ancient sources outside the New Testament later on in today's program. First, much is going on in the news. Now a British citizen has been beheaded. In a recent interview, Obama admitted that going to the golf course right after the news of the first American journalist being beheaded was a bad photo op. A bad photo op. Actually, it was a good, accurate photo of a bad president. And this president has surrounded himself with the most brilliant advisors, such as John Kerry. At a recent ceremony to appoint Texas lawyer Sharaq Zafar as special representative to Muslim communities, Secretary of John Kerry managed to mix the subject of Islam with climate change and the Bible. This was no small task, but he pulled it off. You see, when you acquire an office such as Secretary of State, you develop very keen insight, and you begin to notice stuff that the rest of us just can't see because it's actually not really there. He informed the crowd that America not only has a responsibility to deal with climate change, but that this injunction is a biblical responsibility. Somehow, such obedience to the Bible will also help Muslim countries. I'm quoting Kerry now. Our faiths are inextricably linked on any number of things that we must confront and deal with in policy concepts today. He says, for many of us, respect for God's creation also translates into a duty to protect and sustain his first creation, Earth, the planet. Confronting climate change is, in the long run, one of the greatest challenges that we face, and you can see this duty or responsibility laid out in scriptures clearly, beginning in Genesis, and Muslim-majority countries are among the most vulnerable. Our response to this challenge ought to be rooted in a sense of stewardship of Earth, and for me, and for many of us here today, that responsibility comes from God. That was John Kerry. Yeah, well, maybe if they weren't burying so many severed heads in the Middle East, the Muslim countries would have a cleaner terrain. What do you think? We will mercifully refrain from a detailed examination of Kerry's Bible scholarship. Suffice it to point out, the Bible says absolutely nothing about climate change, at least not in the way the phrase is being currently bandied about. Neither does it link the Muslim faith with the Christian faith, but that's fine. That's fine. Let Kerry believe whatever he wants. A far more interesting observation can be made from his emotionally stirring speech. Have you noticed how the same Democrats who frown at Republicans for violating the supposed constitutional law of separation between church and state are always happy to call upon the Bible when it suits their own cause? Back during the 2004 presidential election, candidate John Kerry recited that tired drivel about being personally against abortion while remaining pro-choice as a public position. And he shared those ideas in an interview with the Telegraph Herald. Now, I guess a few moments ago, I just read his words in my own voice to make this sound more authentic. Let me try my John Kerry impersonation. It's not too difficult. You don't really have to be Rich Little to pull this off. All you have to do is change your voice to monotone. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with speaking in a monotone voice, but I guess when a person's ideas grate on you, their voice starts to grate on you too. Here's John Kerry back in 2004. I oppose abortion personally. I don't like abortion. I believe life does begin at conception, but I can't take my Catholic belief, my article of faith, and legislate it on a Protestant or a Jew or an atheist who doesn't share it. We have separation of church and state in the United States of America. All right, ladies and gentlemen, those are extraordinary words. He does believe, he says, that life begins at conception, which means it has to follow that if life begins at conception, then aborting that life is murder. But as a public servant, he will do nothing to oppose such murder because that would bring religion into the mix. Can't have that. And yet, during this very same election year, while courting the African-American vote, in a speech at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church in Liberty City, Florida, Kerry quoted from the Bible saying, "Faith without works is dead. When I look around me in this country, I see a whole bunch of people who talk about faith. I see a whole bunch of people who put it out there, but I see an awful lot of deeds undone. I see a lot of work to be done in this country." And getting more specific, Kerry included civil rights as part of the religious cause. What's on the ballot is the American dream. What's on the ballot is what Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton marched for. We have an unfinished march in this nation. Now, in all fairness to John Kerry, he is certainly not the only politician to talk out of both sides of his mouth. Nancy Pelosi is also on record. When speaking to the Catholic Community Conference on the issue of illegal immigration, she said, "I would hope that there's one thing we can do working together as we go forward that speaks to what the Bible tells us about the dignity and worth of every person, and that is on the subject of immigration, because I think the church is going to have to play a very major role in how we, in how people are treated." Well, apparently the dignity and worth of unborn children is not to be included here, at least not as far as any legislation is concerned. Pelosi, also a practicing Catholic, parses her stance on abortion between personal conviction and public policy, just as Kerry does. Now, if all this sounds like a bunch of contradictory double talk, have no fear. Nancy Pelosi and John Kerry are actually being quite consistent. You see, when religious beliefs serve Republican causes, they violate our Constitution. When they serve Democratic causes, they don't violate anything. Catching on? Translation. You have no right to refuse same-sex marriage or abortion because that is imposing your religion. But laws about climate change or immigration are fair game, and you may quote the Bible all you want while passing such legislation. Of course, Kerry probably gets his religious cues these days from our president. During his impassioned primetime speech last week, Obama also spoke as a religious authority. He said, "No religion advocates killing." Really? No religion advocates killing. Now, why did he feel the need to go out of his way to say that? Well, because we're being attacked by ISIS, and that is a group that advocates killing. And, well, this group certainly claims to be religious, but why let them speak for themselves? What do they know? They didn't go to Harvard like Obama. Still, even in Harvard, you can miss things. I guess Obama never heard of ancient Canaanites sacrificing babies to their gods. Or maybe he just never heard of Islam. It seems that way at times, doesn't it? But of course, he has heard of Islam. He knows nothing about it, but he's heard of it. He knows nothing about it, so he should quit popping off about it, but he's heard about it. In a previous speech, right after it was confirmed that ISIS beheaded American journalist Jim Foley, and right before Obama headed for the golf course to tee off, he said, "Let's be clear about ISIL. They have rampaged across cities and villages, killing innocent, unarmed civilians in cowardly acts of violence. They abduct women and children and subject them to torture and rape and slavery. They have murdered Muslims, both Sunni and Shia, by the thousands. They target Christians and religious minorities, driving them from their homes, murdering them when they can for no reason other than to practice a different religion. They declared their ambition to commit genocide against ancient people. Now, up to this point, the speech, the president was uncharacteristically accurate in his assessment of a foreign threat, but he couldn't resist adding that tired, obligatory disclaimer that Muslim terrorists are not truly practicing Islam. So ISIL speaks for no religion. Their victims are overwhelmingly Muslim, and no faith teaches people to massacre innocents. No just God would stand for what they did yesterday and for what they do every single day. All right, folks, look, truth and falsehood were woven together in that last remark. It is ironically true that the victims of Muslims are often other Muslims accused of not being obedient enough to the dictates of jihad. It is also true that no just God would stand for such pure evil, but this only begs a much bigger question. Does the doctrine of the Quran lead us to a just God or some other kind of God?
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
We have a president who talks like an authority on Islam, but he doesn't know Islam from Shinola. As for the targeting of innocents, Mr. President, that is exactly what the true Muslim faith does. No, the Quran would not describe its targets as innocents, instead calling them infidels and blasphemers, but they remain innocent casualties by any decent understanding of the word. Now, it is the Quran itself that is being held up to scrutiny here, not the entire Muslim world population. There are many peaceful Muslims in the world who want no part of this barbarity. However, while every Muslim must be judged on an individual basis, evaluating the religion Islam itself is another matter. The jihad commands of Surah 9 and many other passages of the Quran really do call upon Muslims to conquer the world, offering infidels the choice of converting, submitting to Muslim rule, or dying. And that is a powerful and controversial claim. Let's address the anticipated objections one at a time. But Bob, only the terrorists take those words seriously. Not so, my friend, not so. It is true that the terrorists, sadly, are interpreting the Quran accurately, but many Muslims who do not identify themselves as terrorists still abide by their own book. which makes sense. After all, to them, the Quran is sacred scripture. Well, Bob, are you saying there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim? Well, I know many Muslims call themselves moderate, but the Quran itself leaves no room for moderation. Therefore, those who consider themselves moderate Muslims are actually nominal Muslims. What do we mean by nominal? Just as there are people who live in America or Europe who know absolutely nothing about the Bible other than a few choice ideas taken out of context, people who nevertheless call themselves Christians because they were raised with some kind of church background, there are likewise many people born into Muslim countries or raised by Muslim families. If you asked them if they believed in the Quran, they would say yes. If you asked if they believed in the jihad, they would deny it, and they would be telling the truth. There are millions of such people, and yes, they are peaceful Muslims. There are also Muslims who see the jihad verses and choose to just interpret them differently. However, any Muslim who takes the Quran seriously and literally who truly understands the entire message not only accepts the jihad commands, but is also taught that it is okay to lie during a time of war. Why not let Muhammad speak for himself? I'm reading from one of the hadiths. These are the words of Muhammad. Lying is wrong except in three things: the lie of a man to his wife to make her content with him, a lie to an enemy for war's deception, or a lie to settle trouble between people. Even so-called moderate Muslims are allowed to lie during a time of war and deny that they believe in the jihad. And on that note, when is militant Islam not at war? This explains why the allegation of a moderate organization such as CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, having ties to terrorist groups, is not such a stretch of the imagination. Although CARE officials deny the connection, FBI agent Laura Burns, during testimony at a 2010 trial regarding CARE's connection with Palestine Committee and its relationship with Hamas, read from the transcript of a 1993 Hamas supporter group in Philadelphia where the idea of starting a new organization with a less threatening name was being discussed. Her reading was a quotation from Holy Land Foundation President Shakri Abu Baker. He said, and I quote, "And let's not hoist a large Islamic flag, and let's not be barbaric talking. We will remain a front so that if the thing happens, we will benefit from the new happenings instead of having all of our organizations classified and exposed." Well, Daniel Pipes, a terrorist expert, pointed to similar connections in a 2005 article for Front Page magazine. He said, "The Institute of Islamic Thought, an institution linked to Muslim Brotherhood, gave CARE's Washington office $140,000 in 2003. Folks, whether we're talking about Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, or the most current horrific newsmaker, ISIS, it must be noted that these different organizations are really the same cereal in different boxes. The accurate title describing all of them is militant Islam. I don't mind just saying Islam, but I know just as a conventional reference point, just so that everybody knows that there are some peaceful Muslims. Okay, we can call it, if you prefer, militant Islam. All branches, then, of militant Islam have declared war on the non-Muslim, and they have specifically articulated this goal as war against the United States, whether we accept it or not. Just because Obama closes his eyes and says we're not at war, that doesn't mean we're not at war. That's like the way an ostrich would go into battle. Since they get their cues from the Quran and not U.S. Middle Eastern policy, we'd best put away the self-imposed guilt, mindless diplomacy, and the ultimately useless surgical military responses. The only way to end this war is to truly win this war. Yes, there are many nominal Muslims, but a dedicated Muslim who accepts the Quran literally and truly understands the Quran is not allowed to be moderate. It's time for U.S. foreign policy to end its moderation. Do you want to lose your freedoms? I love my freedoms. I think about this every week. A lot of you ask me at times about my schedule. Well, unlike the rest of you, although I take time off, I don't take weekends off usually because Saturday I am spending the day preparing for a Sunday school class that I teach in the morning. And then, of course, for the radio show that I do Sunday night. So by the time Sunday night's over, I'm just ready to relax and unwind. I head out to La Jolla every week. Sometimes I just go over the cliffs and watch the ocean. Other times I do what I'm going to do tonight. I go to one of my favorite coffee shops right on Prospect Avenue, the Living Room, and I just sit and I unwind. And, you know, just to have the freedom to do that. You think they get to do things like that in a Muslim country? Not to mention other countries that are voided their freedom, but we're taking our freedom for granted. We're flushing it down the toilet. Well, if you'd like to weigh in on any of this, you can reach me, of course, through Facebook, Twitter, or directly questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. Last week, we had a very interesting show where myself and co-host Kevin Conover interviewed a Buddhist nun. John writes me and he says, "Hey, Bob, I caught a bit of your show last week. The conversation on whether you actually exist or exist only in someone's consciousness. I enjoyed it very much. So first, let me say that you exist in my consciousness." Well, thank you, John. "And second, I have some thoughts on Buddhism we could chat about if you ever have a moment. I think I'm the only guy that can link Buddha to Marx." Well, John, I'd like to hear about that. On Facebook, Marissa says regarding last week's show, "It sounds like she's saying that reality or what exists is whatever you perceive it to be, but that does not always change what reality is. I perceive that I'm in the Bahamas. This is very positive thinking, but not true." Oh, man. We'll be right back. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480539, W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I've been reading some comments from last week's show, where we interviewed a Buddhist nun. Ryan says, "Great show. I was able to listen to much of it. I especially liked the point about karma and karma getting in the way of somebody's karma, which is why Hinduism brings so much poverty to their untouchables. So sad. The inconsistencies in religions are so bountiful, but the truth in Christ is sustaining." Just to defend our person last week regarding the comment I read right before the break, she wasn't really saying that reality doesn't exist. It was our perception of reality. But I do understand it did sound that way at times. Now, regarding Obama and religion, Melinda on Facebook says, "Guess he doesn't read much." Well, Melinda, there are no libraries on the ninth hole. And regarding my comment about golf, about Obama rushing off and playing golf right after he commented on the beheading, Gary says, "I am ashamed of people making comments of our president like this." What has happened to supporting our president? Even if you did not vote for him or even agree with him, we as a nation need to rally around the good and supporting whoever is our president. Through the years, I haven't agreed with some of our presidents, but have always supported them. By the way, where does loving forgiveness come in? And who are we to give final judgment? Who are we to give final judgment, Gary? Who do we have to be? Who do we have to be? Gary, everybody judges, even you. For example, your very first comment was a judgment of my statement about Obama. You said you were ashamed of the comment. Now, if that wasn't a judgment, the word should be taken out of the dictionary. There are different kinds of judgment listed in the Bible, and some kinds of judgment in the Bible we are actually commanded to give. The only judgment that Jesus specifically forbade was from one who called others sinful but never dealt with his own sins. Now, if you think I'm somebody who has not freely and painfully confessed and dealt with his own sins, then you don't know me or my Christian pilgrimage at all. But we are to speak out against evil, and one cannot offer the gospel of forgiveness without calling another to repentance. As for respecting the presidency, that all depends on who the president is and what the president is doing. The office alone does not command respect. Putting aside his lies since coming into office, lies about Benghazi, IRS, healthcare, let's take a moment to look at his record before he was elected to see if he even deserved this honorable office in the first place. When he voted against the Illinois Infant Protection Act, he was favoring infanticide, not abortion, infanticide. There is absolutely nothing about that to respect. Where does love come in? In life, there's such a thing as tough love. Where does forgiveness come in? According to the Bible, it comes in when a person asks forgiveness. Have you ever heard Obama ask forgiveness for anything? When a person asks forgiveness, takes responsibility rather than blaming everyone else for his failed policies, that's when forgiveness comes in. The same Bible that commanded forgiveness also commands us to speak out against evil and evil rulers. Look at how the church in Germany appears now to our 2020 hindsight for not speaking out against Hitler. Some of them did. Most of them did not. Can you just imagine in those days, you're speaking against Hitler? Yeah, you got to respect the office of the chancellor. You got to at least respect the office. Jesus himself spoke against evil rulers, as did the apostles and prophets. Take care, my friend. Now, concerning my position that Islam is not really a religion of peace, I shared this in my monologue and also wrote about it in my column, Forbidden Table Talk. Irfan says, "It is unfortunate that you consider terrorists more knowledgeable about Islam than people who have spent their entire life studying the Quran. Unfortunately, instead of seeing journalism, I see the worst kind of article, lies mixed in with some truth to make the reader believe what the writer wants. Believing things in this article is like saying that I should believe in Timothy McVeigh's view about patriotism as opposed to someone whose family has been serving in the military for generations." All right, let me respond to this. So these were lies mixed with truth, huh? I have read the Quran cover to cover. What I said in the article and in the monologue version just a few minutes ago on this radio show is the complete truth. I also gave a reference for one of the surahs in the Quran which issues jihad commands, Surah 9. Here, I'll cite it. You already know it's there, Irfan. Who are we kidding? You know it's there. But for the sake of my audience right now, I'll cite it. Believers make war on the infidels who dwell around you. Now, an infidel in the Quran was anyone who would not obey Islam or submit to Islam rule. You want another one? Here's another one. Prophet, make war on the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal rigorously with them. Hell shall be their home and evil fate. They swear by God that they said nothing, yet they uttered the word of unbelief and renounced Islam after embracing it. So why are they making war on these people? Because they renounced Islam, because they were unbelievers. Now, just what part of that do you not understand? Just what part of that are the terrorists reading but the rest of the Muslims aren't? And while we're on the subject of modern-day examples, let's be clear. Terrorists are not the only ones taking the jihad verses seriously. Entire Muslim nations are doing the same thing, jihad and Sharia both. The defense of Islam's peacefulness can be summed up in a simple sentence. Honestly, Islam really is a peaceful religion. We can see where it may not always look that way. No, It does not look that way when churches are burned down in Egypt, or Bibles are forbidden in Saudi Arabia, or children in Palestinian schools are taught that Jews are evil and should be exterminated. But don't assume alternate religions to Islam are the only targets. Homosexuals are executed in countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, Mauritania, Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen. And when those fun, loving Taliban ran Afghanistan, oh, they were a barrel of laughs. They went after homosexuals with special cruelty. Of course, this did not catch as much news attention as their inhumane treatment of women. One of the more creative punishments sliced off the top of a woman's thumb for having the audacity to wear nail polish. Were there moderate Taliban? Sure, they only sliced off half of the woman's top thumb. But when people call this the religion of peace, it's difficult to say it with a straight face. With such persecution of women and homosexuals, one would think these Muslim countries would be more frequently denounced by liberals. They used to be. They used to be. But in an ironic twist of fate, Islam managed to become a politically correct religion. It took 9/11 to make this happen. After slitting the throats of stewardesses, ramming planes into buildings, and then in the months that followed, beheading people like Nick Berg while chanting to Allah and then posting the whole thing on the internet where all could share in the joy, somehow Islam became known as an extremely peaceful faith. And woe to any who say otherwise. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Sunday morning services at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock a.m. Liberals used to speak against the violations of civil rights in Islam, but 9/11 changed that, made them into politically correct religion. Now you have to say that they're a peaceful religion hijacked by just a few nutcase terrorists. Don't you dare say otherwise. Of course, it's always open season on Christianity. An American artist portrays Christ in a bottle of urine without worrying about a group of monks or nuns putting out a hit contract. Meanwhile, film director Theo Van Gogh was murdered by a Muslim for daring to make a film about Islamic violence. Ooh, that ought to teach us to stop calling Islam a violent religion. Ladies and gentlemen, the peaceful wing of Islam needs to make a better case. They can start by admitting that their cousins in the violent wing are indeed religious, not merely people who hijack religion for political gain. Why else would they be going ballistic when a Quran is destroyed, the same Quran which instructs them to make war against infidels? Well, at the top of the program, I told you we were going to have a discussion today about the testimony of Jesus outside of the New Testament. We're going to begin it on this show, and we'll continue it in a future show. These next couple of weeks, I have some other shows planned, but we will continue it in a future show. And they'll all be linked to my website. So you could listen to this as part one, then it'll take you to a link to the next one. But I'm going to start with the resurrection of Christ. Now, if we had 500 people And we did have 500 people that claimed they saw Christ rise personally. If we had 500 people who claimed a man like Jesus just started a revolution or gave a speech, nobody would doubt it. The problem is we have this bias of miracles. We immediately assume that because the historians are reporting something miraculous, we shouldn't accept it. Well, the question of miracles is a subject that might belong in philosophy. It might belong in science. It might belong in religion. It doesn't belong in a history discussion. In a history discussion, the only legitimate questions are the amount of eyewitnesses and the credibility of the historians. When the Bible says that God does a miracle, it doesn't mean that God waves a magic wand. Miracles are very scientific. It's just that God's using a science we don't yet personally understand. The same God who established all scientific law has some laws we don't know about. Human beings probably know less than 1% of the obtainable knowledge in the universe. How does God do his miracles? With the 99.9% of the knowledge that we don't have. Now, before we look at the historical testimony of Jesus outside the New Testament, I don't want you to be so quick to throw out the New Testament itself. One of the problems is sometimes the way we present the New Testament. The minute we call it the Word of God, people get this vision like we're talking about it being sent down from heaven out of a cloud with a white box and a red ribbon. The New Testament is actually 27 different historical documents. And when you look at the Gospels, three of the Gospels were written by actual disciples and eyewitnesses of Jesus. The Gospel of Mark is really the Gospel of Peter. Peter orally communicated it, and Mark transcribed it. Luke, however, was not a disciple. He was an actual historian. And these guys are not talking about some kind of blind faith that you accept in Sunday school. Look at the way they're talking. They are talking as if these things really happened. That's very important. Many times people assume that because we're talking about something religious, we begin with this underlining assumption that it doesn't really have anything to do with truth and facts. Well, the writers of the Bible did not talk that way. I'm reading from the very beginning of the Gospel of Luke. Listen to these words. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Theophilus was a Roman dignitary. It was very common in those days for a patron to sponsor somebody to go out and investigate something. There was so much news that was reaching the Romans about this man named Jesus because of the movement that Theophilus actually commissioned Luke to go out and look into it. Now, again, some of you are sitting there going, I can't count Luke because he wrote in the Bible. Well, we had another guy who once said he couldn't count Luke. At the turn of the 20th century, beginning of the 20th century, one of the most noted archaeologists and honored archaeologists was Sir William Ramsay. But he was very skeptical, did not believe Luke to be accurate, and he specialized in archaeological digs in the Grecian-Roman world and went out to disprove Luke. He came to the conclusion that not only was Luke dead on accurate, but more accurate than many other ancient historians that we accept. So Luke was a historian. Now, John was an eyewitness. See if he sounds like he's talking about blind faith. I'm reading from 1 John, the very beginning. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared. We have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us, and our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete. Now, some of you go, oh, but Bob, these disciples that followed Jesus around, you can't count them because they had an emotional bias. They liked Jesus. So you can't trust anything they say. Well, did the disciples have a bias predisposed for Jesus? Yeah, sure they did in a moment. I'm going to quote to you from a source that had a bias against Jesus, and we're going to look at that too. But let's go back to this bias for Jesus. Yeah, everybody writes with a bias. Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of England during World War II, has a multi-volume set that he wrote about World War II. Now, do you think Winston Churchill had an unbiased view of World War II? Who was right, England or Germany? Probably not. But you see, it depends on how he phrased these questions. Let me phrase it another way. Which historian in his right mind Which thorough World War II buff would be uninterested in a book about World War II written by the guy that had been the prime minister? You see, when we apply these same standards to histories outside of Jesus, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Look at the way people are setting this up. All right, if Jesus really did miracles and rose from the dead, then you need to give me somebody from history who reported it. But the people that loved him, his closest friends, the ones that followed him around for 3 years, ate with him, sat at his feet, slept next to him, they don't count. That's ridiculous. We would never hold another historical event up to that kind of scrutiny. Be that as it may, the Talmud is a collection of Bible interpretations and certain historical events that took place at the time of Jesus in a section of the Talmud called the Babylonian Talmud, a section called the Sanhedrin. I'll even give you the actual verse 43a. They mention that Jesus was executed on the Passover on the charge of sorcery and apostasy. Now, what was apostasy? An apostate was somebody who veered from the faith. In other words, they're calling Jesus a heretic. Well, why did they call him a heretic? They call him a heretic because he actually claimed to be God incarnate. For a Jew to claim under the law of Moses to be the God of the universe was as heretical as it gets, unless he happened to be telling the truth. But they didn't believe he was telling the truth, so they wanted to execute him as a heretic. But I'm intrigued as to why they called him a sorcerer. Why was Jesus called a sorcerer? We'll discuss that when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
To the Bob Siegel Show, the testimony of Jesus outside of history. Now, I already mentioned that people have their biases. Yes, the disciples had their bias. No good, honest historian would leave that out. But I'm also quoting from the Talmud from Jesus' day, a bias predisposed against Jesus from the Jewish religious leaders who took responsibility for his death. They actually turned him over to the Romans, and the Romans carried it out. But they executed Jesus on the charge of being a heretic, because he had actually claimed to be God, but they also called him a sorcerer. Why? Because in those days, if you didn't like somebody and you didn't want to believe he was a prophet of God, but nevertheless, you could not deny the fact that he did miracles. You said, oh, well, he didn't do those miracles by the power of God. He did them by the power of Satan. The Jews believed in those days, and rightly so. And it's still true today that the supernatural comes from God or Satan. Now, for those of you that are Christians, it must be making your stomach crawl that people would have called Jesus a heretic and called him a sorcerer, a worker of Satan. But having said that, I'm hearing a strange thundering noise. Are you hearing that? Oh, my God. And we're hearing that all the way in the studio? Wow. I have been here for 10 years. I have never heard a jet fly over this building before. Anyway, I thought it was the thunder of God telling you to pay careful attention to everything I'm saying. Anyway, in the Talmud, They're calling Jesus a heretic. They're calling him a sorcerer. And we may not like hearing this unflattering portrayal, but from a strictly historical point of view, this is fascinating evidence because we have this testimony outside of the New Testament from people with a bias predisposed against Jesus, which nevertheless confirms that he exists and that he did miracles. That's pretty fascinating. Now, we also had a historian by the name of Josephus. He was a Jewish historian. He was a contemporary of the apostles. He was born very shortly after Jesus' death on the cross and resurrection. In a comprehensive listing of the deeds of the Roman governor Pontius Pilate in Judea, he casually mentions Jesus. Now, we know for a fact that this man was not a Christian. He actually believed that the emperor Vespasian was the Messiah, so he was not a Christian. But he still, to be comprehensive and thorough, mentions Jesus. And the fact that he only writes a couple of paragraphs about him, of which I'm reading one, shows that he's not taking the kind of interest that a Christian would make. Nevertheless, listen to what he says. Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day. Now, this is pretty fascinating evidence. So how do people try to get around this? Well, it's actually very simple. They say, well, Josephus didn't really write that. As time went on, the works of Josephus fell into the hands of the Christians because Rome became Christian. That's true. That's also true of all ancient literature from Greek philosophy. You go on and on. So why didn't the church go in and change a bunch of other things? They didn't, because they had integrity. It's there. It exists in every extant manuscript of Josephus. If somebody wants to make the case that Josephus didn't really write it, the burden of proof is on them. Now, one of the reasons they claim this is they say, well, if Josephus said that Jesus was the Christ, and if Josephus actually claimed that he rose from the dead, well, then he must have been a Christian. But notice how people set this up. They say to me, Bob, if Jesus really rose from the dead, then somebody other than a Christian would be writing about it. And I go, okay. Well, somebody other than a Christian did write about it. Josephus, they go, oh, well, he doesn't count. Oh, well, why doesn't he count? Because he says Jesus rose from the dead. Only a Christian would say that. You see, you give people just exactly what they ask for. This is what I call circular reasoning. They asked for somebody who would acknowledge that he rose from the dead. It was possible in those days to believe somebody could rise from the dead without actually becoming a Christian. Josephus, as a matter of fact, belonged to the party of the Pharisees. They were known for believing in the resurrection. He could have believed that a body popped out of the ground without believing that he was actually somebody to follow. And then you say, well, Bob, why did he call him the Christ? Okay, well, to the Jews, Christ was the Greek word, comes from the Greek word Christos. Christ is kind of an English transliteration, meaning Messiah. To the Jews, calling him the Messiah would be very significant. You need to understand, though, that although Josephus was Jewish, he lived in Rome and wrote the history of Israel for the Romans. To the Romans, that word would not have meant anything, and Jesus was a very common name. In fact, I have a copy of the complete works of Josephus in my library. There are 13 different Jesuses that he talks about. By calling him the Christ, he might be merely pointing out which particular Jesus he's talking about. And then some say, well, but he said if it be lawful to call him a man. Yeah, but the Jews gave those kinds of hyperbolic statements at times. If it be lawful to even call him, it could be a way of flattering him. Or there are all kinds of stories in the Old Testament, which Josephus believed. There were times when angels would take human form. He might have believed that Jesus was an angel, but he wasn't a Christian. And yet here we have a historian from the time of the New Testament, not a Christian, who says Jesus existed, was executed, did miracles, and rose from the dead. Now, some people will ask, if Pontius Pilate really had him executed, wouldn't he have written a report of this and sent it to Rome? Yes, he would have. Well, has that report survived? It has not. I'm going to read from the New Testament scholar F.F. Bruce. He says something very interesting about this. People frequently ask if any record has been preserved of the report which it is presumed Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, sent to Rome concerning the trial and execution of Jesus of Nazareth. The answer is none. But let it be added at once that no official record has been preserved of Judea, which Pontius Pilate or any other Roman governor of Judea sent to Rome about anything. And only rarely has an official report from any governor of any Roman province survived. They may have sent in the reports regularly, but for the most part, these reports were ephemeral documents, and in due course, they disappeared. So we wouldn't expect that or any report to have survived. However, having said that, Pontius Pilate wrote more than an official report. He also wrote a personal letter to Emperor Tiberius. This letter is called the Acts of Pilate. Have you ever wondered where Matthew got a lot of his information? You get to the end of the Gospel of Matthew, and a little of this is in the other Gospels, but mostly in Matthew. There are things that Matthew, as a disciple, would not have been an eyewitness to. For example, they talk about the guards at the tomb claiming that the boulder had been rolled away, and they talk about earthquakes and the dark. It's just, well, evidently, Matthew got a lot of that information from Pilate himself. In this document called the Acts of Pilate, Pilate, not a very nice guy when he had Jesus put to death, was so overwhelmed by the miraculous nature and the missing body that he himself became a Christian, wrote a report to the Emperor Tiberius. Tiberius was so impressed, he actually went to the Roman Senate with his somewhat misunderstood view of religion and asked them to classify Jesus as a god. The Senate turned it down and did not do it. So this is a fascinating document, the Acts of Pilate. Now, there is one problem, and it's a significant one. This letter, the Acts of Pilate, has not survived. But that doesn't mean it didn't exist. What has survived are four documents referring to it and quoting from it. Justin Martyr was an early Christian apologist. He talks about the Acts of Pilate. He lived in AD 150 during the reign of the Roman Emperor Antoninus Pius, and he was trying to defend Christianity from another Roman persecution. So he wants to convince this emperor, first of all, that Christianity is no enemy of Rome, but also that the report of Christianity is true. And I'm quoting from him. He says, "And the expression 'they pierced my hands and feet' was used in reference to the nails of the cross, which were fixed in his hands and feet. And after he was crucified, they cast lots upon his vesture, and they that crucified him parted it among them. And that these things did happen, you can ascertain from the Acts of Pontius Pilate." Now, what Christian apologist is going to write a Roman emperor who could have him arrested and tell him confidently to go check the Roman archives and check this document if he wasn't absolutely certain that it was there? Justin went on to list many of Jesus' miracles, such as the healing of the blind and the lepers. He also credits Jesus with raising people from the dead. This description of Jesus' deeds is concluded with the following words: "And that he did those things you can learn from the Acts of Pilate." Now, Tertullian, another Christian apologist, he lived between AD 160 and 220. He wrote to Roman officials about the unusual events surrounding the trial, death, and resurrection of Jesus. He also refers to the Acts of Pilate, discussing a time when the Roman Senate actually considered classifying Jesus as a Roman deity due to the miraculous nature of his life. He wrote, "To go back to the origin of such laws, there was an old decree that no one should be consecrated a god by an emperor till he had been approved by the Senate. Marcus Emilius followed this procedure in the case of a false god, Alburnus. This reinforces my argument that among you, godhead is conferred by human approval. If a god does not satisfy man, he does not become a god. So according to this, it is for man to show favor to God. Tiberius, then, in whose time the name of Christian came into the world, when a report of this doctrine reached him from Palestine, where it originated, communicated to the Senate, making it clear to them that he favored the doctrine. The Senate, however, because they had not examined the doctrine for themselves, rejected it, but Tiberius stuck to his own view and threatened to execute any who accused Christians." In this same letter, Tertullian specifically mentions the armed guards at the tomb, the sealing of the sepulchre, the rolling back of the stone, the guards scattering, the earthquake, the darkness, the spreading of a false report about the disciples stealing the body and Christ's last words on the cross. And after this long discourse, he says, "All these things Pilate did to Christ, and now, in fact, a Christian in his own convictions sent word of him to the reigning Caesar, who was at that time Tiberius." Well, I will see you next week, or maybe tonight, if you happen to be at the living room, you see somebody unwinding over a cup of coffee, and the guy just looks for some reason like he might have just been a radio show. Well, That's me.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.